I'm John Kroll. For decades, newsman Mike Ahearn was the eyes, ears, and voice for Indianapolis and Indiana. As the longtime anchor for Wish TV, Channel 8, in Indianapolis, he brought the day's events to generations of Hoosiers. Whatever the story was, he was there, a calm and reassuring voice and presence who told us not just what was happening, but what it meant. We're going to take a look at Mike Ahearn's iconic career with the man himself. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits at WFYI.org. Facebook is nolimits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today with an iconic figure in Indiana journalism, longtime Indianapolis anchorman, Mike Ahearn. Mike, welcome to the program.
John, great to see you again. Thanks very much.
It's good to have you here. I'd like to invite our listeners, and I suspect there are going to be a fair number of you who are going to want to catch up with Mike, to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, I'll start first. We will walk down memory lane here during the show, but probably ought to let people know what you are doing now, since you've been off the air for a couple of years. So what is life like for Mike Ahearn right now?
Well, it's pretty active, John. Actually, I'm associated with American Senior Communities. They have some 60 elderly care locations around the state. I became involved really because my mother was a resident at two of their facilities some years ago, and she was so impressed by their care and professionalism and the warmth of the staff that when the opportunity became available, I became a kind of a spokesman, interview subject, a speaker on their behalf. And most recently, involved with the fraud prevention program for the Marion County Prosecutor's Office and the Attorney General's Office. As you know, seniors are unfortunately a target of some egregious scams out there. And so our job was to try to make them aware of what's lurking behind that next phone call they may receive. Also been involved with Boomer TV and brand new program on Channel 8. Patty Spittler, my old colleague down Channel 8, is the host of that program. That's a boomer for the baby boomers, obviously, the generation that now occupy some, 25%, I guess, of our population.
Yeah, the cannonball and the python.
Exactly.
They call us. Yeah.
And the program is aimed at concerns that they may have, challenges in their lives today. So pretty full plate right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your career. I mean, you worked almost exclusively here in Indiana, mm-hmm, right?
Exactly.
For those listeners who always thought there was a Mike Ahearn on the air, that you were as eternal as the earth itself, how did you get started in the business?
Actually, I got started very, very young. I'd like to say I got started when I was 9 years old. I became fascinated with broadcasting. Used to do play-by-play baseball games in my bedroom of my home on Ruckel Street, making up lineups, and had a little reel-to-reel tape recorder, and became involved at Notre Dame when I was a student there in the student radio. Wire Radio, the OWIRE radio, which was owned by the Indianapolis Star and News at the time, and then from that point over to Channel 8, and that was back in 67, so some time ago, and was there for 37 years. And along the way, wrote a couple of books and wrote a column for the Star and had a Indianapolis monthly column. Was a bi-monthly column. So that's pretty much in a nutshell. And you're right, my entire career has been located right here.
What was it? I mean, age nine is pretty young to start focusing on this. What drew you to it? I mean, was there someone you admired, yeah, or who, what, there, who was?
Actually, it was a baseball announcer, a fellow named Harry Heilman, broadcast baseball games in Detroit. Back when we lived in the suburb of Detroit for a while. And for some reason, I just got hooked. I thought, this is what I want to do. And so from the time I was, you know, could barely even speak, I wanted to be a broadcaster of some kind. And I was really lucky because I got a chance to broadcast news in the town I was raised in, Indianapolis, and to wear makeup. You know, so all of my childhood goals were achieved right there.
And so you decided really early that you wanted to do this, but mm-hmm. It sounds like your first inspiration was sports. When did you shift over to wanting to do news?
Well, yeah. In fact, I did sports up at Notre Dame for 4 years, play by play and baseball, football, anything they wanted me to do. The shift really happened when Wire Radio decided to form a news department when I was down here working in summers. Doing fill-in work and disc jockey work, that sort of thing. And it's a long story, but I'll shorten it very, very briefly. I happened to be in the break room one day getting a cup of coffee, and the police radio, which we had sitting there, was obviously a confrontation down at the old courthouse downtown. And so I had a tape recorder, and I thought, I'll just pick it up and go down and see what's happening. Ran down there, and it was a man who had a confrontation with police on the steps of the courthouse. He had stabbed his ex-wife, actually, after a divorce hearing. So I got some natural sound of that, brought it back, ran it on the air, which had never been done before, apparently. And Gene Pulliam Sr. Mm-hmm. had heard that. He was driving back down from Muncie to Indianapolis in his car, heard that on the air, and said, you know, that's something we should do. We should have a news department. So apparently that's how I got into news, sort of through the back door.
We've gotten an email question. If you're just joining us, we're talking with legendary Indianapolis newsman Mike Ahern on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. We've got an email question from a listener named Doug who says, Mike, you took a sabbatical from your retirement with your talk show on WISH-TV mm-hmm. a few years ago. So were you at all surprised when Debbie Knox returned to CBS4 to be that trusted voice for Tribune Broadcasting's new news brand in January?
The answer is I was stunned. Yeah, I really was, because Debbie, had a long, long history. I think she and I set some kind of a meet, course, and pool record for anchor.
How long did you?
Longevity? 22 years. Yeah, 22 years together.
That's unheard of in that business.
Absolutely unheard of. And so when she retired, I thought, you know, like I did, I said, not, I've had enough. But apparently she was lured back, and I don't blame them for going to her, because they were forming a new news department. They needed a trusted voice. They needed an anchor, a real anchor, and they had Bob Donaldson in place. Of course, people knew Bob and admire his work. But Debbie was there and available, and I am surprised, though, she took the job, because, you know, it's more years of working late nights.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think you have particular authority and could talk about is, you know, the assumption is that because it's TV and all of that, that it's effortless and you know, there aren't sacrifices. I don't think people get how disruptive that kind of schedule can be to anything resembling a normal life, that you're working when everyone else is off, and you're off basically when everyone else is working.
Yes, that's true, and it is disruptive. We when I retired, in fact, having a normal dinner hour or going to a movie, even, you know, it was a luxury. Finally, I was able to do that. My wife and son put up with a lot, you know, like being stopped in shopping centers, people wanting to talk about issues of the day, and they just want to, you know, get on with our lives. It's a price that you know, you pay, because comes with the territory. But it really is more of a burden on the family, I think, than the individual. But yeah, you're right. It does, and you work strange hours. You go in at, you know, maybe 1 o'clock or 2 in the afternoon and work until almost midnight. You know, it's crazy.
So all of the, yeah, the time that other people are getting together and all of that.
Yeah.
Gotten another email from a listener named Dave, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, it's been many years since I've heard his voice. He still sounds like a 40-something anchor man that will always be in my mind's eye. Great to hear from him. I'd been wondering what Mike was up to. It's, you probably get a lot of that still. I mean,
yeah,
since you are here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm still. And the funny thing is, you know, every time I hear from somebody and I really appreciate that kind of response after all these years. I've been retired for 10 years now. And I always think of Ray Meyer. Remember the former coach at DePaul mm-hmm. University? Mm-hmm. And he was being interviewed on a Cubs broadcast once between innings. And they said, Ray, you're looking great. And he said, oh, man, he said, I wish you hadn't said that. He said, as far as I'm concerned, there are three stages to life. Youth, middle-aged, and, you know, you're looking great. So I do appreciate any kind of reaction like that. Thank you very much for the email.
Certainly. In terms of this, I mean, you probably get a lot of requests since you are out and about, and it's not, you know, I mean, people recognize your face as much as they do your voice and all of that. I'm assuming that it's fairly common they say, you know, why aren't you still on the air? What do you tell them?
Well, I don't hear that often. I think people realize I've been on for so long that they wonder why. They probably are wondering, why didn't you get off earlier? But I do get some people wondering if I was going to go back to working again on television. I probably would if the right opportunity came along. But it's really a young person's business, you know, and especially with the multitude of communication platforms now available in the business. It's a fast-moving, fast-paced younger business. I wouldn't mind doing commentary, that sort of thing, you know, analysis. That would be kind of fun to do. But as far as full-time work on television, if it's there, it'd be great. But right at this point, nothing's happening except for those American senior communities working for them, and I'm really enjoying that work.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss being the face of a city?
I miss the big stories. I really do. If there's something really happening that gets the adrenaline going, I don't miss the day-to-day stuff. You know, I don't miss the run-and-gun type news and the repetition of it all. I don't really miss that. Every time I did a story toward the later years of my career, I was thinking, yeah, didn't I just do this story last week? You know, but when something big comes along, I kind of wish I was back in the seat again.
What was the best part of that job?
The best part for me was the and this sounds corny, the communication with the audience, probably best exemplified by the blizzard of 78, mm-hmm. when we went on the air all night to broadcast about the great snowfall. At that time, stations were not staying on the air all night like they do now. We signed off, and we decided to stay on the air during the blizzard. And I'd like to say it was my idea, but it was an engineer at the station who said, you know, we ought to stay on the air. We've got a whole storage room full of old Sherlock Holmes movies downstairs, the Basil Rathbone series. Mm-hmm. Let's run those. And then Stan Wood and I would cut in during the evening to tell people what's going on. It wasn't so much we were providing information, because there wasn't a great deal back in those days. You didn't have the bells and whistles you have now in weather. But it was like some ladies had the best description of it. She said, if you felt like you were holding our hands, we're out here isolated in the country with a foot of snow outside our windows, not knowing what's happening. It was like an electronic friend, you know, sitting there saying, it's okay, everybody else has got the same, you know, problem. There's a foot of snow out there. It's being taken care of, you know. And we just were, and that's, that sort of thing is the most satisfying to me, is when people can respond like that.
Most of my career was spent as a print journalist,
right.
And I've long thought that that's one of the big differences between the media, the two media platforms. There was dealing with that kind of emotional attachment. I mean, the sense of connection the audience has with you, ever difficult, or was it reassuring?
Reassuring, and really, you know, as you know, when you're covering a story and the story's breaking, you're thinking about your job, the story, whether it be the 9/11 attacks or the Bobby Kennedy story when he delivered his iconic speech about Martin Luther King here in Indianapolis. No matter what the event is, you're thinking about getting that story on the air accurately and quickly. And later, you feel, I think, the emotional pull of the story. I think later on, you sit back and think, wow, that was something, you know.
We are talking with iconic Indianapolis newsman.
That means sent me around a long time.
I'm making him uncomfortable. Mike Ahern here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. If you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at nolimitswfyi. Or if you want to tumble upon us on Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. Again, we're talking with Mike Ahern here on No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with longtime Indianapolis anchor Mike Ahern here on No Limits. We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Jim. If you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Jim asks, could Mike tell us how co-writing a novel with former WRTV news personality Reed Duffy came about?
Yeah, that was fun doing that. Reed and I are closest friends, and he and I are both Notre Dame graduates, and you know, we're both in television, so we have a lot in common, and we both have kind of a strange sense of humor. So it was my idea, actually. I've always wanted to write a comic novel based on maybe 60% of reality, of what really happened to us in our careers, and the rest being obviously fiction. So this is a work of fiction. It was called Festerwood at Five, Festerwood being a fictitious small town in western Indiana. A young reporter, not a young reporter, but a sort of middle-aged reporter trying his damnedest to get out of town, you know, get a new job, and how he's caught in the middle of a ersatz hostage situation. And it, but Reed and I just simply got together, traded ideas. He would write a portion, I would write a portion, and then we'd gather our thoughts. And it was amazing how it came together with one voice. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure it was going to work, but we think it did. It was fun to do.
I also wanted to ask you, and I can see the phone lines are going to start filling up here and all of that, so I wanted to get to this. You know, what are the stories that stick in your memory as the big ones, the most significant ones, and to some degree just the most fun ones, too? Yeah. I mean, I realize the big ones and the most significant ones often aren't fun.
No, you're right. And the biggest one would fall in that category. That would be the Tony Caritsas case. For those who are not familiar with it, it's just a real quick sketch of what happened. Tony Caritsas had a beef with a mortgage company executive downtown, wired a shotgun to his neck, paraded him through the streets of downtown Indianapolis, took him out to his apartment building and held him hostage for 3 days and three nights. This was the same time, John, that we were starting to work with mini cameras, the small portable mm-hmm. cameras. We didn't have to lug huge camera units out to the field. And, of course, film had long been replaced by videotape. So we had news gathering tool at our disposal, which made us very powerful and very vulnerable at the same time. In effect, Tony Caritsas was almost daring us to cover this story, and we did. We rushed right in and covered it to the very end, to what is now referred to, I suppose, as his tirade when he went on television, demanding coverage. You have to remember that. He was demanding coverage.
And he would kill.
Or he would kill this man. And you could see on camera this shotgun wired to his neck. And somebody said, why couldn't the police send a sniper out and pick him off? It was apparently rigged so that it would go off.
Yeah, for those people, I remember watching it on television. Yeah. I was at that stage. It was like a piece of baling wire or something like mm-hmm. that around his neck, strapped and connected to the barrel of the shotgun, which had been sawed off, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And you know, the thing was cocked, so that it was ready at any jerk, and it would have gone off, and there was no place for the shells to go other than right into this guy's head.
Yeah, and then that third night, the last night, the pivotal night, when Karitsis was had his so-called news conference, what he called at the complex out there. I can't read. Boy, this image, John, will be in my mind forever. I'm sitting in the newsroom, and I'm working on that night's newscast. And up on the TV monitor is the People's Choice Awards. I'll always remember this on CBS. John Wayne is receiving an award. Suddenly, John Wayne turns into Tony Karitsis, because the engineers had plugged in, because Tony Karitsis at that moment demanded live coverage, and there was no time to talk this over. And they decided to go ahead and go on live with it. And the phone lines, of course, lit up. People were complaining about not so much they might see an assassination, a murder in their living rooms, the profanity of Tony Karitsis' comments.
He was dropping an F-bomb.
Every other word, And to me, that wasn't the profane part. The profane part was that we had established ourselves in a position, we put ourselves in a position to maybe be carrying a live murder on television. And this is a watershed case. I mean, nowhere had this ever happened before in television. Television news was still fairly young at this time. And I thought, my God, we're about to show an assassination. Suppose somebody had a heart condition or children were watching or something. And and obviously it didn't happen. Tony Karitsis did give himself up. But you'll recall what the verdict was in that case. It was innocent by reason of insanity. Today, of course, now the defense must prove the insanity plea, but back then he didn't have to.
Well, and what the other part of that is, it wouldn't even have had to have been deliberate. I mean, if you watch the thing, as you pointed out, I mean, the two of them had been up for three straight days without sleep.
Right.
So, I mean, that added to the kind of jitteriness, and Karitsis was not the most balanced guy to begin with, even if he'd had a full 8 hours of sleep. So there was a chance that a stumble, a twitch, or anything like that could have been seen. I know from talking to you in other contexts in the past that you've got a lot of ambivalence about the way that story was handled.
Yeah, I would have done it differently. It was so new to us. It was a life or death situation that could have been broadcast live. This wasn't a sitcom. This is the real thing. And what I should have done was gone on the air and warned people that this is a live broadcast. We advise you to turn off your TV set if you don't want to see this, or just to say we're not going to show you this. I didn't either. I just let the thing ride because I was so stunned, as everybody else was, by what was happening right before us. And if you remember, I became somewhat of a nag about this and, saying let's be careful in the future about going into willy-nilly, going into hostage situations, whether it's one man's vendetta against another, whatever it happens to be. Let's be careful going in, because once we're in, we're in. We've committed ourselves to this story, and we had committed ourselves to Karitsis, saying to the viewer, this man may kill someone, so, stay tuned. And unfortunately, I think if we turn the pages back, I would do it differently.
It's hard, though, and I want to have, for those listeners who didn't see that, to understand the content. I mean, the implied threat from Karitsis also was, if the cameras don't show up and the microphones don't show up, I'm going to kill this guy.
Yeah, but we had set ourselves up to be manipulated like that. I mean, we cannot absolve ourselves of blame on that. And I'm not saying we had no history of it. Covering that kind of news. This is all brand new to us. You'll recall just a couple of years later, the Iranian hostage situation, and the cameras rolled in, the network cameras, willy-nilly, and started covering every demonstration. Not to say it's not news. I'm just thinking, when pictures arrive so quickly, like they do now with,
the immediacy.
With social media, you have to be careful. What you say, the words must be in context and must be as a perspective to what you're showing. And so when that happened, you remember the first person to get in to see the Ayatollah Khomeini? It was not Cyrus Vance, the Secretary of State. It was Mike Wallace.
That's right.
He was the 60 Minutes guy. So in effect, this is an exaggeration, but television had replaced normal diplomatic channels in some respects. So That camera is a very powerful instrument, and now the camera's inside a telephone. So it's you have to use extreme amount of caution.
We are talking with longtime Indianapolis anchor Mike Ahern here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Russ, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I'm not on air right now, right?
Yes, you are on air.
Okay. I wanted to, on a much less serious note, I wanted to ask Mike about his perspective on using the humorous segment at the end of his broadcast. I was the victim or honoree of one of those in 1991 when I drove my ice boat into the lake and had to get rescued. And the next day, he introduced my story by reminding the audience that in Bambi, Thumper's mother had explained to him that the ice was on the water because it was too cold to go swimming. He then said, apparently one of our local doctors forgot his classic children's literature yesterday. I thought it was a very humanistic way to present what could have been a tragedy, but turned out just to be semi-interesting. And it speaks to his commenting about communicating with the audience. I just wonder what he thought about, in general, his use of the humor business at the end of this broadcast.
Well, thank you for that.
Thanks very much for the comments.
I do remember that story. Thanks for the call. Yeah, of course, now it's done as features primarily on the network, or sometimes local news will drop one in. A lot of that is gone now because news is so fast-paced, and there's so much of it, and there's so many choices out there. And, you know, we're in a 1,000-channel universe now. There's not time, really, for that kind of news story. Back then, it was fun to do. I can see where there's probably very little place for that kind of story today. But they exist sometimes at the network level.
How much of that was a product, though, of the fact that there was a long-term relationship between you and the audience here, that, you know, to a degree, because people, even by 1991, you'd been on the air for close to 25 years, right?
Pretty close, yeah.
At that point. So, you know, I mean, you're a fixture here, and people are consider you almost a member of the family. Did that allow you to tell stories or tell them in different ways that, you know, now in TV business, particularly in a market like this, we often, it's supposed to be the launching pad to one of the really big markets.
Yeah, that's a good point. There was a revolving door atmosphere here for many, many years, and people would move on. And I think one reason that I was able to establish that contact was because I was part of the, as you say, part of the fabric of this community for many, many years. And it allowed me perhaps to inject more of my own personality, opinions into the newscast than is possible today. Although I will say today, John, the chances are the news that you tune in tonight will not be the same news that your neighbor is getting, because there are so many choices now, and so much of it is opinion news on cable, especially. And people have to be careful. I think I do. I advise audiences to sample as much as they can, because there's very little mainstream so-called news out there. Most of it is opinion. And a lot of that, Bill O'Reilly, for example, has a tremendously loyal audience, and yet he has just a fraction of the overall audience that the network news has. But is the audience for Scott Pelley, say, at CBS, as dedicated? No. And it's because he injects himself into the story.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named John, and if you'd like to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. John says, I'd like to hear what Mike Ahern has to say about the death or murder of the fairness doctrine on journalism and politics. Well, I think we know where John is coming from on that one.
Well, of course, you know, the fairness doctrine is, gosh, it seems like ancient history, doesn't it?
Probably ought to explain what the fairness doctrine is, too.
It dictated pretty much to broadcasters that they had to cover certain stories of common public interest, and then present the other side of the story in fairness. Because of that, there was a lot of controversy over whether or not that should be allowed to stand. Today, of course, it's almost a moot point. There is so much to choose from, that the fairness is there to begin with. There are so many channels to choose from, so many radio stations to choose from, that you it's no longer really an issue at this point.
Also gotten a Facebook message from a friend of yours, co-worker Ken Owen.
Oh, yeah, Ken.
Says, loving the show. Tell Mike I owe him lunch. So, we're now passing along private messages here, but yeah.
That's a major story if Ken is going to pay for lunch.
Well, I hope you heard that one, Ken. He's been a guest on the show, too.
Yes, Ken's a good guy.
A caller who didn't want to go on the air asked if you could comment on your time at the Speedway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. I was, I was fresh out of college, and Sid Collins had heard me do some basketball broadcasts. I used to broadcast all the high school basketball games here as play-by-play announcer. Mm-hmm. I did 9 in one day once out at the old Butler Fieldhouse, now Hinkle Fieldhouse, back when all the games were played in this general area in one place, and that was the Fieldhouse. So Sid had heard me do that, and I was just a kid, and asked me if he had a slot open in the Speedway network, if I would do it. And I said, gosh, my knowledge of the Speedway is of a fan, and that was about it. But he put me up in turn 3 and then turn 2 and then turn 1, and I was there for like 12 years. Great experience. Sid was one of the all-time great broadcasters as far as I was concerned. Man who just was almost scholarly in his preparation for his broadcast. And he was a tremendous ad-libber only because he practiced to get it just right. But those were great. I can't say I was a great Speedway announcer. I was not one of the better ones because I was not a full-time sports guy at that point. I was back as I was news at that point. But those were good years, and I enjoyed the experience.
What's the biggest way that the business changed in your time doing it? I mean, that you've got a window on a slice of broadcasting history, yeah, of Indiana history as well.
Yeah. Well, the biggest change, obviously, is the number of, for the technical thing, that was the biggest change, obviously. Yeah. When I started out, we had black and white news film, mm-hmm, and color news film, then came along, and then cameras. So the change has been technological, primarily, and that's driven pretty much news content along the way. Trying to keep up with the technological advances has been a big challenge for news people, because the stories happen so quickly and they're at your fingertips so fast. You have this instant communication, and what do you do with it? You know, how do you handle that? You don't have all day to craft a story to put it together like I used to have. You know, now, and I will have to say, John, I'm not one of these old timers who wails away at the loss of old-time television journalism. I really admire what's going on today as far as the younger reporters. They have to think on their feet all the time. They're producing in their head. They're writing the story in their head. They're performing the story while the producer is talking to them in their ear. You know, it's a whole different kind of journalism, and it's one that I personally admire. I'm just glad I don't have to do it right now, because it's someone who's very, very quick on their feet.
Well, and the concern these days about this, about that immediacy, and
yes,
you know, that's always been broadcast's tremendous advantage, is that it could be immediate, and print tended to provide context, and there were jousts back and forth. Right now, though, the immediacy means that there's almost no filter, mm-hmm, and in theory, that's what the journalistic sensibility was supposed to provide, was the filter. Does that trouble you at all?
It does. It does, and that's the biggest. Next to the technological advances, I think the biggest problem is how do you handle that in terms of, as you suggest, is there any longer a gatekeeper for news, or is news simply whatever is available on social media? The problem there is, once a person with a camera phone or somebody has an opinion and tweets it, and the mainstream media suddenly picks up on it, then it becomes news, and then all of a sudden it gets into the whole mix of, what is news and what isn't news. That bothers me, and I'm not sure if there's any. There's no going back, obviously. So you have to deal with it. How you deal with it?
The genie's out of the bottle.
The genie's out of the bottle by that time. Yeah.
We are talking with longtime Indiana newsman Mike Ahern. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or reach out to us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with longtime Indiana newsman Mike Ahern here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Wanted to ask, you know, we talked about probably the most difficult story and the one that lodges in your memory as the most ethically challenging. What are some of the other significant stories, and what was the takeaway for you from doing them?
I guess the one that will always linger is the Bobby Kennedy's speech out here at 17th and Broadway, the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Everybody is familiar by now with the video of that story. Mm-hmm. Reuven Frank, a former NBC producer, once said, "Television has become such a part of our lives that if we do not see something happening on television, chances are we don't think it really happened." You know, and I thought at the time it was kind of almost a frivolous comment, but when you stop and think about it, the Bobby Kennedy story is probably the best example of that. Kennedy made a speech out at 17th and Broadway. At that time, the motorcade following him, the press motorcade, the CBS crew became distracted and lost, or something happened. They didn't get the video of Bobby Kennedy's historic speech. I remember sitting in the newsroom that night, and the CBS photographer was there, and he was just crestfallen. And I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I just found out Walter Cronkite is going to lead his special report on King's assassination with the Bobby Kennedy speech tonight, and we don't have it. We missed it. We weren't there for the thing." And about that time, Dave Brady, who is our chief photographer, walks in waving this canister of film, saying, "How soon do you need this Kennedy video?" You know, and the guy, the CBS guy, jumped up and literally ran across the room and hugged him. He said, "You just saved my job." Well, he didn't say job, and he said, and it's true, you know. And now stop and think about it. If that video did not exist, and that's the video you see most often, the color video, kind of shaky, shoulder rig, and it's kind of raining, and it's, you know. And if Dave had not shot that night, if he had turned off the camera, if something had happened, that story in many people's minds would never exist, because a newspaper account of that would not be nearly as dramatic or as provocative as Kennedy's speaking live there in Indianapolis that night. So there's a story where Reuven Frank's prediction that if it didn't happen on television, it didn't happen, in many cases was accurate.
Two things have always struck me about that. One, you know, how would it have something like that have been covered now, with attention spans being shorter and all? I mean, you know, in those days when you started, a soundbite was what? You could go 30 seconds, maybe?
You could go 30. A minute would be like a documentary.
Yeah, 30 seconds. But now it's really down to about 8 seconds,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
In commercial broadcasting. So it's a third. So what you see is just the idea that a speech like that, which was not a long one, he did not talk that long.
No, he didn't.
Would have probably not been shown in its entirety.
Well, I think maybe that probably would be, because there's so much time to fill. You know, once the television news is on now, and because it's repeated so often, and there's so much of product to get out there, I think probably a story like that would get a full attention, because of the nature of it and the fact that it was Bobby Kennedy. But I do think that you're right. In most cases, a story like that would maybe get 10 seconds.
Well, and I'm thinking, I mean, he quotes in that speech, you know,
Aeschylus. Yes.
I'm thinking, okay, where's Wheel of Fortune right now?
People are writing to the Roger.
Yeah, to figure figure it out. We've got a question from a listener named Chris who reached out to us via Twitter. And if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. It says, Chris's question is, Mike, what are your thoughts on Wish losing CBS?
Yeah, that's a tough one. That is a tough one. Oh, I was so shocked. This is a, you know, a kind of an internal story, but basically what happened, every few years, the network and their local affiliates have this little dance they do. The CBS has to be paid a certain amount of money for the program content it furnishes to the local station. And every few years, they go round and round over how much it should be, and every year, every few years, the network ups the ante. This time, the Chicago Tribune syndicate came along that runs Channel 4 here and and said and they entered the picture, and they brought a lot of bucks with them. And as I understand it, the Wish TV just called the network's bluff, and at the last minute,
and it turned out they weren't bluffing.
And they weren't bluffing this time. Yeah. And really, you probably used them as a, maybe just an example to the rest of these stations in the affiliation that, look, you know, we did it at Indianapolis. We could do it to you if you don't play ball with us. It's too bad. It's too bad because it's a long affiliation. And I just, you know, everybody, I think, was shocked.
What, I mean, in some ways, television always has been competitive.
Yeah.
But now, at least in this market, you've got five different stations trying to do news. It's almost like the Wild West.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Right now, where it's relentless. Do you have any thoughts on that development, whether, A, this market can sustain five newscasts, or...
I'm not sure if it can or not. People are so used to seeing news whenever they want to see news that I think newscasts as such, the half-hour block or the 45-minute block or hour-long that we used to have, are probably not as relevant as they used to be because you can get the news almost any time you want it, especially national. The cable's around, cable news is on all the time. I'm surprised that network television news has survived as long as it has because those stories that CBS and NBC and ABC run at night have already run all day long anyway. Locally, I think it'll survive in some form. I'm not sure the number of stations that will survive. But I think there's only one way to get local television news, and that's with your local television news station and the weather, which has become extremely important in coverage. So I think, yeah, I think it'll survive all right. I just don't know. The pie gets smaller and smaller, John, every year. You know, there's more and more competition.
And more people wanting to eat from it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so something has to give. Yeah.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Darren. And if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Darren says, great to hear Mike again. Why is so much of the local news dedicated to negative stories? Why are those stories deemed news? I do not watch the local news due to such negativity. He also says, thanks you for your service and sends a thank you along for a great show, which you're helping make possible. So I'll extend that thanks too.
Well, thank you. And I think it really depends on your definition of the word negativity. If you're a politician caught with your hand in the till, you know, it's negative news for you. It's great positive news for the audience who's been spared this guy's misdeed. So it really depends on your definition of it. I will say there is probably too much emphasis on the easy news, and that's the accidents and the shootings and that sort of thing. You know, there's a lot of that still. I'm surprised there's that much still on the air because I think people may be tired of that kind of repetitious newscasting. But it all depends on your definition of negatives. To me, a negative story would be one where we missed it. You know, we missed a good story that should have been covered.
Those competitive pressures were talking, I mean, the cliche always for television news, even in the era in which you were working, was if it bleeds, it leads,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I can tell just from talking with you, it sounds like you weren't even comfortable with it back then.
No,
you're less
I was
comfortable with it now. If you were building an ideal television newscast, what would it look like?
Well, probably have no viewers, number one, because because, you know, I wouldn't, it probably wouldn't be as dramatic or as theatrical, maybe as television news can be, with the with the tumbling graphics and the nervous music and all the mm-hmm. you know, all the stuff that's attendant to
that
it.
That Stephen Colbert makes fun of.
Yeah, exactly.
The yeah. eagle flying yeah. in and out.
I think that there would be more emphasis. Okay, this is the perfect newscast. Again, I'm saying it would probably never succeed, but it would be one where fewer stories are covered in more depth, and there's a bit more stories concerning taxes and your school system and, you know, and the environment, stories that really make a difference, and not who was shot at 16th and Ritter. You know, I mean, it would be a different style of newscast. And again, I'm not sure how many people would watch it, though.
We've got an email on point from actually Indianapolis Star columnist Matt Tully.
Oh, yeah.
Says, what issues, topics would he like to see covered more by the local news?
I think I just touched on them there. I think that the stories that matter to people more than anything else, and that would be, you know, taxes, school board meetings, state house news. I think Jim Shullo for years has done a great job down at Channel 8 covering that beat. But again, that's a beat. And the beat system in television news doesn't really exist except in rare cases like Jim's. I'd like to see more people dedicated to that story or to that area of news. So stories like that would be have more content and that matter to people. People talk about it's just everything else seems so run and gun and rat-a-tat, the news, and it happens so quickly. And there's no substance to a lot of time right now.
Which role? I mean, you really kind of filled two roles at Wish for Years, the whole anchor, and then but you were also a reporter at the same. Which of those did you prefer, or did you make distinctions between them?
Well, I didn't report that much, John, to be honest with you. I was probably more anchored than to the desk than I wanted to be, but that's just the way things were. I enjoyed really the feature reporting then. I said earlier that, you know, those kinds of stories aren't run much on the air anymore. But I kind of enjoy doing that. I like to write, and I think the stories that involve the video as well as the written word with a little maybe a substance or a certain attitude, they were fun to do. I did some specials, half-hour specials of original writing, that sort of thing I enjoyed. But I didn't get out and cover the news like I should have been able to do, and probably looking back now, I should have done more of. But the thing about, you know, Brian Williams, I don't know if this is going to come up in our conversation, but that really was stunning to me, a man with that those credentials, that professionalism. He was so articulate. He has such a great sense of humor on the air, you know, to put himself in that position. Because the one thing that anchor person has, the only thing you've got, the main thing when it comes down to, okay, why do you watch this person, is credibility. And when you lose your credibility, you've lost it all. And I think that's what happened to Brian Williams. I think he embellished. I think he made stories up. I have a personal... Nobody else shares this opinion except with me. But I just had this feeling that you were at the print journalism, that print journalists had a kind of not a disdain for, but a suspicion of television, of broadcast news, because of a couple of things. One is we had to condense our stories to the very basics, so therefore we didn't really cover stories in depth the way we should. And the other was the theatrical part we mentioned. You know, it was, there's some show business involved, let's face it. You know, you have consultants, you have makeup, you have it's theater as well. And because of that, I think a lot of anchors especially, and I put myself in that category, felt almost an inferiority complex at times, to say, you know, trying to prove we're real journalists as opposed to performers. And I think, and I may be totally wrong, but I think part of this was Brian Williams' mistake, in that he wanted to prove that he could get out there and cover the news and be a put himself in harm's way, and face the danger of covering news, and as he did that, he had to prove it again, maybe to another degree, and he kept embellishing his stories. He didn't have to do that; he already had that kind of following. But I have a feeling there's some of that still in us that we're not quite convinced that the audience is convinced that we have the wherewithal to get the job done. And that's primarily, you know, I think some of that had to do with his decision.
How much of that, though? I mean, I hear what you are saying about Brian Williams, but obviously there have been notable scandals of, you know, New York Times reporters embellishing or outright making things up. You know, how much of it is that hyper-competitive pressure at the national news level? And I guess that's my way also of asking, you know, why you stayed as long as you did in Indianapolis, because you were an anchor at a phenomenally young age.
Yes, yes. I was in my late 20s.
And clearly could have been marked, you know, to go on up. What kept you here in Indianapolis?
Well, I think the job, and you get right down to it, the job is the same no matter where you go. You know, the money's more better somewhere else, and of course the landscape is different, but basically you're doing the same job. Why not do the job where you are, where you know the territory, you know, where you know who is making news, what's important, the society that you're living in, the culture that you're living in. And so that's really, I was comfortable here. I had a good job. I enjoyed what I did, and I could do it pretty much, you know. I didn't have carte blanche, but I had a loose rein on, you know, what I did on the air. There was one period, as you suggested earlier, kind of a revolving door atmosphere in this town. Indianapolis was a stepping off point for somewhere else. But that is no longer the case. I think you look at the anchor teams now. Mm-hmm. Here. They've been here for quite a while.
And I guess the we're getting close on time here. Mm-hmm. I've asked you about, you know, the most difficult, sort of the most meaningful. What was the story you did that was the most fun, that you just enjoyed?
Yeah, almost any feature that I did that was fun for me. I did a Christmas show every year or for several years of original writing and covering, you know, it's just sort of whimsical thoughts about the Christmas season. That sort of thing I enjoyed strictly as separate from my news persona. You know, this is a whole different thing. A story like the Blizzard of 78, we get back to that again, but that was the kind of thing that I enjoyed doing because it was connecting again to the audience in a very real way. And there were stories that, you know, I'll tell you, the political conventions which I covering the Indiana delegations, those were always fun to do and worthwhile because you got a chance to get out of the studio to get to a whole different location, especially back in 88 when Dan Quayle was chosen and the hubbub surrounding that, which is a story in itself. But those kinds of things are what I enjoyed.
And I think that is will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank you, Mike, for coming
thank
in here.
Thank you, John.
And we've been talking with Mike Ahern here on No Limits. Invite our listeners to come back here on Thursday when we're going to be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Bill Foley, who's the subject of a new exhibit at the Indiana State Museum. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.